Hi, and welcome to the latest episode of Security Nation, the podcast where we talk to interesting people doing interesting things to advance security. I'm your host, Jen Ellis. I'm Rapid7's VP of Community and Public Affairs. And as usual, I'm joined by my co-host, Todd Beardsley. Amazing Todd. How are you doing, Todd?
Hello. Amazing Todd. Okay. Amazing. I'm great.
Like Amazing Grace, but more Todd-esque. Uh-huh.
And we already have a Grace. So.
We do. Who is amazing? Why don't we call her Amazing Grace all the time? Oh, because it'd be annoying.
Starting now.
Right. You know who else we have this week? We have amazing Oliver. Oliver Day, who is going to join us and is going to talk about embedding security in engineering, which is actually one of our favorite topics. We are big fans of the, what I'm going to call SecOps, because that's literally what we call it. So that's what it is. Before we get to talking to Oliver, we are, as usual, going to do the rapid rundown, and Todd is going to tell me what's happening in security.
So the big news for the rapid rundown this week is, you guessed it, updates on BlueKey.
Woo! That's your fave!
I love talking about BlueKey. It's so interesting. So during the last couple weeks, there was an outbreak, I guess is how you would describe it, of attacks involving BlueKey. It was all kind of lame. It wasn't a worm. It was super crashy, all that. We've already talked about that before. But the interesting part that we can talk about this rapid rundown is that these attacks caught the attention of our buddy ZeroSum. And on November 7th, ZeroSum posted a pretty long technical deep dive on why the BlueKey exploits that are floating around are so crashy. And it turns out the culprit is Meltdown. Yes, the speculative execution bugs of a year or two ago are screwing up how BlueKey exploits work, mainly because the common case these days appears to be that Windows machines that are vulnerable to these RDP bugs are incidentally also fixed for the Spectre and Meltdown bugs in a lot of cases. And so this is changing the way that kernel memory management works in the wild. This wasn't noticed or considered during the lab-based exploit development, but turns out the real world is different from the lab. So
what?
Yeah, I know, right? and it's real interesting too. Like, and this is kind of like a fundamental feature of exploit development that we run into occasionally, where earlier patches may not fix the issue for later vulnerabilities, but they twiddle some things. And so we've all said that like the BlueKey exploits are all very fiddly. It all has to deal with like the spooky kernel memory management. And this is a perfect case where, you know, memory management is getting affected by some patches that appear to be pretty popular. So hooray for Intel and Microsoft for getting good patch rollout on Spectre and Meltdown, which is not surprising. It got a lot of news, you know, a lot of like mainstream news. I heard about it on NPR, which was weird. You know, so I think that it's interesting in terms of exploit development. It's interesting in terms of like when we actually start seeing attacks in the wild, how that feeds back into, you know, security research. And so we have a fix in on the Metasploit module now. It deals with this. It deals with the way that all the kernel memory hooking works. And if you are interested in reading up on ZeroSum stuff, just look up ZeroSum on Twitter. You'll find a link to his blog. He doesn't post super often, so it should be near the top there.
So I want to make sure that I understand, because this sounds like the most InfoSec-y story I've heard for a long time. So, well, firstly, like the InfoSec community is disappointed because the exploitation that they're seeing in the wild is not cool enough for them. Am I telling that correctly?
No, it's I guess we were all expecting, you know, a big flare up and catching like a lot of people's attention as people's, you know, just stuff just got burned down to the ground, right? But the thing is that like the attack was, you know, it ended up with a lot of blue screens of death, a lot of BSOD crashes, which are super obvious. So it was like easy to detect, easy to, you know, to just notice that you were getting attacked at all. It hit a bunch of honeypots. It wasn't very targeted. And ultimately the payload was installing a crypto miner, which is about the best kind of payload from like a victim point of view that you can get, because crypto miners just kind of like, you know, they'll work your fan, but they don't really hurt. You know, they're not, it's not ransomware. It's not, you know, permanently breaking devices. It's not shells.
This is such the cyber put down. It'll work your fan. Wow. Yeah. Like that is cold, literally, in all the ways. Okay. And so as I understand it, so it's lame. It's not interesting enough. And people are being saved by a prior bug, Vuln, that they've patched.
Well, and that's another interesting thing too, right? It's like we've said before that like IDS can like interrupt these attacks just by like triggering on the payload and then killing the connection. While killing the connection will also cause, you know, these blue screens of death. Turns out these earlier patches are also air quote causing blue screens of death because they are changing the way that that memory layout works, which is like the whole point, right? Like that's why you have these patches. But it, you know, it changes the profile, like the vulnerability profile. So again, like kernel exploitation like this is always super wanky. Like it is.
I'm sorry, what now?
It's janky. It's jinky. It's wanky. Yes. It's like all of those like funny words that mean like, not quite right. Because when they fail hard. And this is terrible for pen testers and like for criminals too, because like you get noticed.
All right, so we don't like it. I feel like this is what happens when you give a thing its own sound effect. After that, it just can't live up to the pressure. It's never going to be able to like be what you want it to be, Todd.
Oh, well, don't worry. Now that we are learning more about how kernel exploitation works in the wild, I expect a far more stable exploit to come out. And probably at some point, maybe another 2 months, 3 months, maybe over the holidays. Like this kind of vulnerability is great for ransomware. So like the moral of this story is still patch your stuff, patch against this bug, please. If you're exposing RDP to the internet, please stop. If you absolutely can't, which I cannot think of a reason why, if you can think of a reason why you need RDP on the internet, please let me know.
So thank you for educating me as usual. And now we get to talk to Oliver. Oliver is a security professional working at a medium-sized publisher. Before he worked at said publisher, Oliver started a nonprofit providing security services to other nonprofits, which I think is like the coolest thing ever. I love that he did that. He's a super community-minded person. And before that, he worked at Rapid7, like a million years ago. How long ago did you work at Rapid7, Oliver?
I think it was about a half a million years ago.
That is not what you're doing today. And we are going to talk about what you are doing. But before we get to that, let's learn a little bit more about you. So Todd has a question that he's been dying to ask one of our guests. So Todd, take it away.
Yeah. All right. Oliver, not counting the movie Hackers.
By the way, should always be counted.
Yes. In fact, should just be the beginning of every question, not counting the movie Hackers. Can you talk about, describe a scene in a hacking movie that that speaks to you?
So I'm a pretty old person. I think politely we say old school or like OG or something like that. But I'm like that generation. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of us have the same answer, which is sneakers. And it's to me like the best representation of what hacking was in the golden age or could be in a new golden age. But you know, like in sneakers, like it was, you know, these guys just figuring out how something worked, right? And they had this device that was from the NSA that could basically just break all encryption. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly they were like, well, hey, what about all those? Who has a black book of like encrypted websites? Or it wasn't even websites back then. They're like, hey, let's log into the, you know, Federal Reserve node in Virginia, and they like log in. They're like, cool, who wants to crash the economy? And you know, it's like this sort of like discovery, and just, you know, they spent the whole movie just figuring out what this device even was. Mm-hmm. And they were the only ones really in the world who could even say like, oh, okay, I know what that is, and I totally know what we can do with this. And then they like go on and like decrypt like FAA traffic, and they're like, hey, does anyone want to crash a jet? And that's when they kind of have that moment of clarity, and they're like, dude, this is really not okay. There's actually the really dreamy hunky dude from forever ago.
Robert Redford,
thank you. Yeah.
He is dreamy and hunky.
Right? That's a pretty accurate description. He was like, guys, we cannot do this. And I you know, that's one of the best moments for me. It was where he says, guys, this is totally wrong. I get that you're giddy with power. Stop it.
So you're saying that your favorite hacker movie moment is realizing that terrorism is wrong.
It's yes. Yes. Yeah. It's in realizing that hackers have amazing powers and that they can be used for really good things or really, really bad things. it's up to you guys to choose what you do with your life.
I like that. Use your powers for good, not evil, Todd. And the others. I don't want to single you out, Todd. So what you have undertaken a role, and you have made a sort of shift in that you are embedded with the engineering team. Is that correct?
Yeah. I took a role that was supposed to just be DevOps. They added security engineering because they saw my background. But when I started, it was really just learning how to DevOps in this company. And that means learning how they deploy their infrastructure, which they, keep as code, and then learning to write the code to deploy new infrastructure. And as I did that, as I actually contributed to the team effort, what I found was that, eventually there would be a crisis. And at that time, they would ask questions that were security related. And that felt like the natural time to put on the security hat versus as soon as I come in the door saying, okay, I'm the security guy, this is what we need to do, and just throwing, advice at them. And I think the other thing that really helped in the beginning was something that Wendy Nather said, which is, if you're asking, like, why don't you just do X, it means you probably should find out first. So I went about asking, so why do we do this way without making any judgments against them? What is the story behind this? And sometimes the stories were okay. And it's like, okay, that's a pretty valid business justification. And other times they weren't. And what I told the first guy that I worked for, he's left and I have a new boss now. But, the first guy, I was like, I'm never going to like yell at you about security stuff. I'm just going to take a lot of notes and then we're going to have discussions later.
I mean, that seems like a good way of building like a little bit of trust and a little bit of empathy. I think like giving people the benefit of the doubt is often harder than it sounds like it should be, right? Like that seems like something we should all be able to say, yeah, we do that all the time. We have the enough sort of basic mutual respect for each other to give each other the benefit of the doubt. But actually when you get caught up in the thing and something seems obvious to you, it gets hard to do that and to operate that way. And I think when you do, it makes a huge difference to the tone of the conversation and the tone of the response you get and how open people are to listening.
Yeah. And I think... there's one person, I wish I could remember her name, but one of the advice she gave me, she was like learning to become an executive. And she said, even a CTO should be a CEO once to learn how to sell. And honestly, that's what I've kind of learned here is like, there was a security, there's this one part, one facet of our security that I've been unhappy with. I'm not going to say it out loud, but it's something I've been unhappy with for 2 years that I've been here. And it's only in the last 6 months that the CTO has relented. And I don't mean that I was hammering away at him, but I would just bring it up like, well, I would really like this security goal to happen, but I can't because of this one policy we have. How about if we just carve around it and do this? And then the next time we would carve around it and do this other thing. And eventually he was sort of painted into a corner. It's like, look, can we just get rid of the policy? And he did. He eventually said, yeah, let's do that. But it took 2 years, a year and a half, and it took being told no a lot and not being upset about it, not saying, well, then I quit. You can just be hacked, be whatever happens, you deserve it. Like, which I feel is sort of the common response, from security people. Like, well, if you don't listen to me, you're going to get hacked. And whatever happens, you deserve it. Like those words literally come out sometimes. And it's not, I don't think it's super helpful. It hasn't been helpful here anyway. And then, I've been able to make very small incremental changes. Like, well, we have this thing like deployments, and it was like one guy, or a data fix is a really good one. There was there's like data fixes that we get tickets for. And there was like one guy in charge of it, or one guy who would do it. He was the only one who could do it. And I said, well, this is a single point of failure. Can we instead create a rotation around this? And they took that idea and implemented it in other areas, like, who's triaging bugs and who's doing this. And now we've, taken this sort of security concept and implemented it in other places. And they don't even realize it's like, it's their infosecking, like that's what they're doing, but it doesn't matter to them. What I've done is said, look, here's a tool. Like, this isn't a requirement. Here's a tool that will help you solve a problem you have. And they're like, oh, that's actually kind of cool. Yeah, let's do that. Versus, here's a requirement. If you don't do it, you're fired. They tend to push back.
Yeah, I mean, yes, absolutely. And I think if you demonstrate the value to the business, then people don't care what the label is that goes on it. They care about the value that you're demonstrating, which it sounds like is exactly what you were able to do in this situation.
And I love the way you phrase that, because I think that's something that we also as a community need to do. And I'm the first person I've heard really talk about this was Justine Bone. She gave a keynote at Source Boston, and she basically said, look, you guys that are snickering at the word cyber, you are literally pushing yourselves out of conversations with stakeholders. You're laughing at them. They're now going to ignore you. And guess who controls your budget? Who controls your headcount? Who controls literally everything above you? And you're snickering at them. That's never going to work. For me, like I started at, like, they would give me these privacy projects. And I was like, you guys understand, like, I have a background in law. I'm not a lawyer. I do security stuff. I'm not a privacy person. Like, you're conflating two things. But eventually what I realized was, if I wanted my objectives to be taken seriously, I would just have to accept they would be lumped under privacy. And now I have a privacy and security roadmap. Hooray for me. And all my security goals are getting pushed through. And sometimes I call it security.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like what you've done is that you've wrapped your security in a privacy blanket, right? Mm-hmm. And you can kind of smuggle them through that way. So good social engineering, Oliver.
Thank you.
I mean, I think the bottom line here, the bottom lesson is figure out what the business cares about and what's relevant to where they are now, and then figure out how to make yourself relevant to that. Like, that's how you get people interested and you get people to the table. And that actually, by the way, is like an incredibly standard negotiation tactic. That's a normal empathy. Negotiation tactic. It isn't even empathy. Like, you don't have to. Empathy is a scary word for a lot of people, and they feel like they have to develop a new skill. And it actually isn't really about, like, you don't have to care about what they care about. You have to know what they care about and know how to map what you care about back to that.
Yeah, and in your case, Oliver, it sounds like privacy was the thing. I mean, I know at other places, like, a great backdoor for security is just talking about availability and uptime, and then, you know, sneaking security in on that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like the single point of failure stuff. Like, okay, this is why we're going to divide into a team.
Yeah, and sometimes that doesn't resonate, so you got to try something else.
Yeah, well, and so it's interesting on that point, right? Like, one of the things that's helped me a lot, and I wish that I had come up with this on my own. I did not. I first read about this on a blog from Fastly, the CDN company. And they basically had this entire several posts, about why security teams should adopt the language of Agile when working with engineers. And I was just like, that's actually quite brilliant. I was working at a different company at the time. And so I started, I was like, okay, well, all right, as SecOps, we want user authentication to use slow hashes. Okay, that feels good. And, you know, then it was just like learning Jira and learning how to break that down into other stories and stuff. But what I found was that bringing a Jira ticket to a group of engineers was way easier than any other way of packaging that request, right? By saying, look, here's a Jira ticket. I've broken it from an epic down into multiple stories. Everything has points assigned. Here are all the components that it affects. Here's some release dates. What do you think? And suddenly they were just interacting in a Scrum meeting like it was any other ticket. And they were saying, well, okay, yeah, I could do that. And, you know, let's sequence it in after this because it might affect this other thing. And, oh, Oliver, have you thought about maybe implementing it this way? Oh, no, I didn't. Okay, let's do that. And suddenly I was speaking basically their language, you know, and they could talk back to me in a way that I could accept, you know, like I could take in and understand. It made it so much easier. Dina Dizavoy also, I probably butchered his last name, but he's also talks about this stuff a lot and has really good advice about learning to work with your engineering teams instead of what I almost feel like in other places I've worked at was against the engineering team. Like, it was this antagonistic relationship where I was like out to, you know, find all the flaws that they were coding before they shipped. You know, it was like, it didn't feel right. It really did feel like I was working against them instead of with them.
I think to your point that both a lot of security pros and a lot of engineers do feel that way. They do feel, I think, like, it's a lot of security pros feel like they're seen as being the bad guy and they're unappreciated. I think a lot of engineers feel like they, you know, put all of their time and effort and blood, sweat and tears into their code bloody code is the best code. And you know, some smug security person comes along and tells them that their baby is ugly, with no appreciation of the time and effort that goes into it. And to your point, like, I think when you learn to work within the framework that other people like, I mean, even stupid stuff like, you know, we have conversations here when we're working cross-functionally about, like, will we use Confluence for something or will we use Slack for something? And, like, sometimes for the people who are not in the engineering teams, we, like, have a real eye roll and we're kind of like, those are not the tools we like to use. And, like, we don't think they're actually the best form of communication for this kind of situation. But we have to play the, like, okay, this is where we'll accommodate you game, and this is where we'll need you to accommodate us game. And, like, before you can bring people to where you want to be, you have to bring them along with you, which means you can't be super arrogant about it. You have to start where they start and try and fit in with their workflow. And I think it sounds like you've done that incredibly effectively.
Thank you. Yeah, it's I like the way you framed it, because it, you know, like, I recently had this this task where our vendor, I won't describe who, but they're pretty good. They came in, did an assessment, they figured out something about our login system that wasn't great, so we were going to introduce rate limiting. And by the way, just for security professionals who have never dealt with the remediation aspect, I plead with you to go speak with people who have gone through it. It's not as easy as you think. And you say, like, you should just change that. Like, it can take months to, like, work out the plans, write the code, migrate things. So anyway, just this one rate login thing, I ended up breaking about 3 or 4 spec tests, like our spec tests. And it turns out, like, I'm not the smartest guy in the room when it comes to writing our spec tests. I'm very good with security. I'm like a middling cryptographer person. But, like, when it comes to writing our spec, I'm awful. And I think that's where a lot, at least the people that I've worked with that I don't really respect anymore, that's where they always fell short to me, because they were like, look, we're security. We are at least senior level engineers anywhere else. And I'm like, dude, you're really not. You can't have that attitude.
I mean, like, and here's the thing is, and I think this is true in the issue between security people and engineers or breakers and builders, if you like, as much as it's true in the world that I sit in, which tends to be more like policy conversations. The ideal thing is when you bring multiple people to the table who have different skill sets and expertise, and you can put those skills together and learn from each other. If everybody had the same skills, like, a lot of us would really be redundant. So it's much better when we can learn from people who have different complementary skills to us. Breakers are good at breaking things. That's what they do, and it's a super valuable skill to have. But it's not the same as building. Mm-hmm. And it's important to recognize what builders bring to the table. There'd be nothing to break if builders didn't have to make stuff.
Exactly. And if you're a breaker, please recognize you might not be the best builder in the world. And respect the builders that you talk to, you know, like, they have a skill too.
I feel like I got very soapboxy in this episode. I apologize. So tell us, like, for somebody else who wanted to go about this and, like, you know, emulate what you've done, build a program like yours, what would be your number one piece of advice to them?
So my number one piece of advice would be that the product owner of the product that you're trying to improve is the number one relationship that you should focus on, cultivate, and protect, because that person literally controls the flow of resources and time and energy that goes into the product. And if you want any chance of your security improvements to be taken seriously, that's the person to convince. And I have a pretty good relationship with the product manager here. And sometimes he's like, dude, I don't feel comfortable with this. And one time he was absolutely right, because I made a change to our password reset system during our peak registration time.
Ouch.
Really stupid and short-sighted of me, by the way.
But props for pulling it out, right? And props for learning from it.
Yeah, no. Well, and the thing is, if I hadn't had a good relationship with our product manager, I probably would have been in a lot of trouble. But because he and I talked about it, and then I came into his office one morning when we were having some issues, and he looked at me, he was like, we maybe shouldn't have done this during registration peak time. And I was like, yeah, I agree. Let's never do this again.
That does sound like a very productive relationship.
It is. And like I said, there's stuff that is going to get, you know, put on the back burner that I'm super into, but that's fine. They're going to eventually, they will eventually work their way into our product. That I'm convinced of. Because I think I've developed enough like respect here that they're like, okay, some of his ideas are a little out there, but eventually we do come to agree that like, that's, you know what, that's what all of our auditors say we should be doing. That's what all of the security experts say we should be doing. So let's just go ahead and do it. And let's figure it out, you know, like figure out how. And I think that's like the biggest lesson. Not the one about, you know, protecting your relationship with the product manager, but like the secondary one is like, if you've never experienced the remediation side, I very much wish that you would at least ask some people to just walk you through, you know, how hard is it to change from, say, a fast hash in your password field to a slow hash? Like, what is it like to really migrate from, say, SHA-512 to Scrypt? It sounds super duper simple. It's not. It is like insanely difficult. There's so many moving parts.
I think walking a mile in other people's shoes is great advice. Todd, have you ever done that?
Have I ever migrated from SHA-512 to Scrypt? No, I have not. And I'm blissfully ignorant about
that. No, that was very specific. But what I was actually more getting at was the walking a mile in other people's shoes. And I think you have done that. I think you have sat in the engineer seat and in the breaker seat.
Yeah. I mean, it's the same deal in like, you know, like project management kind of stuff, right? Like you always have to be, you have to be talking the other person's love language when you are assigning them tasks.
Oh my God. Did you say love language?
I did say love language.
This is the best podcast ever. Thank you so much for coming on and telling us all about this. And, you know, congratulations for, it sounds like a pretty healthy relationship there that seems to be yielding great results. And good luck for the future.
Thank you very much. Yeah. And I really love the podcast. I did actually listen to podcasts. You made fun of me when you first started talking about this, but I did. And I have to admit, as soon as I heard you interview Wendy Nather, I was like, I'm totally in. I'm totally doing this podcast because she is legitimately one of my heroes. She's amazing.
Oh, she's one of my heroes as well. And I love the fact that she brought us credibility. I will totally tell her that. Obviously, she listens to this all the time. No, she doesn't. She's busy. But I will totally tell her that is the case. That is hilarious.
Yeah. No, the Securing Change nonprofit, like when we first started, the security poverty line was inspirational to us. It was like one of the ways that we could best describe the thing that we were trying to fix in the world.
It's not just an amazing piece of work, but it's an amazing encapsulation of a problem. Like she tells the problem in a way that everyone can relate to, and has been very profoundly impactful, I think. Well earned praise there. Thank you. Thank you for coming on. Todd, thank you for co-hosting, particularly as I know you're not feeling great still.
It is my pleasure.
And Bree, as ever, you're amazing and we appreciate it. Thank you. I say this every week, but I don't think what you guys know is that I'm actually gazing at her adoringly as I say it, which is so awkward for her. So thank you, Bree. We appreciate it. All right, we're out. Bye.